You are listening to Jaya Ashmore. You can find hundreds of meditations and talks on my websites, jayaashmore.org, jayaashmore.org, as well as opendharma.org, opendharma.org. All the recordings are offered in the tradition of generosity or dana, and your gifts are welcome. Thank you for listening.
Would anyone like to ask or share anything? Sorry. Would anyone like to ask or share something?
Wow.
We were doing the same
cool.
thing for a month. And at first I was just amazed at that big arm and such a little one. I just thought, just see this doing what we're doing.
Cool. Thank you.
I loved working with the bones and the lungs, but one thing that I was surprised by noticing with the bones was how spacious they felt. I think I was like looking for something really dense and heavy, and you said that. But there's also this lightness and fluidity. Yeah, it just felt like they were breathing. I love getting past the preconception.
Yeah. Cool. One time I had the chance to do a workshop with Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen. So if you're visiting, we did have, are there the two of you? And oh, I thought you'd been here all day. Okay. Are you familiar with body mind centering Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen? Okay. So we did lungs and bones earlier today. So it was a workshop where part of what we were feeling into was the evolution of the human form, and so feeling how the in the evolutionary swinging, how the first little flipper came off, and then how that extended and then grew an elbow, and then extended and grew a wrist, and that kind of thing. Or maybe, I don't know if it grew the wrist first and then the elbow, but anyway, it lengthens and then divides. But she was going around the room, and she happened to come to my little threesome when we were just feeling into that, the sense of how naturally something would grow off to the side. And I'm just also just sharing the amazing moment of just having her put her hand on my shoulder while I was like, I'm not sure if I'm really feeling this, and then just, oh, that coming out of the concept and into the, something that feels more living, yeah, and without words. So even though this is called the Dharma Talk, maybe the quiet time we had at the beginning was the more important moment of our 45 minutes of Dharma Talk. And while listening and participating, asking, sharing, we can play with feeling that room, so kind of like the way that when the living bodies didn't have limbs, and then this possibility of something growing, and the bones have these beautiful spirals in them often. And so this at first it wasn't bone, it was fluid. And then the fluid started to almost like the way sand is shaped by the water that would run over it. So just start to take this spiraling, lengthening movement, and just feeling like we've been playing with serious and playful, or playful and, what was the other word, majestic, or playful and, anyone remember from this morning?
You were saying demanding.
Yeah, yeah, playful and demanding. So we can, if we think of our history as living creatures, all those ancestors, it is often the case that it's both playful and there's a demand. Like, I need to be able to pick up food now because it's not, I'm not just breathing it in or whatever. Like, there's a demand that if we can let it there, we can accept the demandingness with playfulness. And if we can be playful in a way that's open to demand, then I think these just very deeply natural really evolutionary leaps happen. And it's that kind of feeling of, oh, it felt so good to come out of the preconceived, the thoughts of bone as something solid, hard, full of itself, kind of, that actually, whoa, one experience, one person's experience of space there. Yeah. And it's, I'm just kind of got wowed myself, because really what I want to talk about today is the feeling of ourselves right now, as Claudia mentioned this morning, kind of starting to be able to think for ourselves about what's true in ways that weren't possible 50 years ago, 100 years ago, etc. And so there's a lot of crisis, and there's a lot of crisis energy, and that's true, and that's happened, you know, many, many times through our ancestry. If we think of living creatures, there have been how many times that the planet completely froze over, called Snowball Earth, once or twice, as far as we know, completely. Not just an ice age up here and down here, but like, whoosh, ice. And life continues. Amazing. Or 90-whatever% of creatures gone, and yet then something comes through with that, like, there's room for playfulness, and there's also some kind of demandingness there. And I feel, as human creatures, the disintegration of traditional cultures leaves a lot of vacuum. It leaves us pretty shaky. It leaves us pretty vulnerable and very, very open. There's so much openness, you know, there's the good side of it. There's the possibility of feeling from where might a new form that's really beautiful, that looks dense and hard, but actually inside it is spacious and light, and allows, you know, gives support for standing up, or gives support for moving an arm that is in harmony with a crane. And so I'd also like to have in the back of our minds today, and maybe through these next couple of days, a different sense of the word voice, not just about words, but about, maybe we can call it communication or reciprocity, togetherness, I called it this morning, that things can, we could mutually enhance each other in ways that are both very personal and also completely impersonal. So this morning I talked about mine, not mine. So, and in the movement, it's not, what does my personality feel comfortable with and feel uncomfortable with? That's not so interesting. That's the project we were given as children in this country, mostly. what, you know, what is your personality, develop your personality, which is kind of develop your preferences within whatever subculture you're in. But something that still, it's not that we would all move our arm the same way. Even though the lungs, my personal lungs, your personal lungs, it is so personal, and yet neither of us made our lungs. Our lungs are making us. And so there's something completely impersonal about lungs, and beyond the human as well. It's an expansive species wide kind of form. I mean, beyond species. I mean to say beyond species, beyond our species, to so many species that have lungs. So just to give us some feeling for, and literal examples in our body, in the shape of our form, in the shape of our physical form, everything is so personal and so impersonal. And that can give a flavor and a kind of leading edge to get really into and really hungry for the quality of what Rachel described of, oh, the feeling of coming out of the preconception into my discovery. And in a way, actually, Cheryl, you called it silly, but in a way it's kind of your movement led you to look up just at the moment that some huge metal that had been taken out of the earth is swinging around in the sky. I mean, it's kind of, if we didn't see cranes all around and think of them as machines doing construction for some dirty business or whatever, you know, it's like, amazing. There's metal going around in the air.
It got me thinking about it is doing a good job. It's doing this
I feel more interested in the part where you're feeling friendliness with that, you know, and feeling that different perspective shift of, well, it's doing a job. It's in the world. It's not some other world. It's in the world, and it's part of us somehow. I think that can be interesting to feel into when something gets us thinking. Like when that getting me thinking is really just a perspective shift and like, oh, wow, I never saw that way. Or I realize I always saw that way. And that's not the only way to see something. And when something gets me thinking in a way that's just more thinking quality instead of discovery quality and kind of hovering close to the discovering. So I feel like recently, those of you who know me know that I like to bring poetry when I can into the retreat space. And recently, I find that my even most beloved poets, I feel like, yes, and, like, come on. Or going much further back in time to, and then there's translation issues, like who translated this from Sanskrit? And I don't have enough Sanskrit to kind of do my own translation, and maybe don't know enough about the culture to really, to be sure that this isn't some kind of misinterpretation, like interpreting too small. And so I have a couple of poems, but and they're mostly to get the feeling of maybe, this is maybe, where our elders have brought us to, that open-ended space that our elders have brought us to, and they can't go from here. And guess who can? But it's like very demanding. And it's not through when we think of demanding and like, okay, everybody tighten up, you know, get tense, get alarmed. You know, that's what we usually think of when we think of something demanding. We either think, oh, I can't, or I will, or, oh my God, I don't know if I can, I better try really hard. And that hasn't worked ever, you know, except maybe by mistake. Whereas that, like, playfulness, or just like, just almost like, just for fun, let's have flippers. Just for fun, let's lengthen the flipper so long that then it becomes, there's a joint, and like, oh, wow, we can. So the first poem is by Lucille Clifton, and I hope you might have heard me read this before or seen it on my website or whatever. It's Mother Tongue. I think we might have even read it here last year. Mother Tongue to the Child Just Born. And Mother Tongue is tied together with a hyphen. Mother Tongue. Okay, sorry. Just before we go into the poem. Sometimes it can be helpful to think of ourselves, though we have grown-up bodies, as children, and how that has a good side and a bad side. And in this kind of cultural background where we find ourselves, where there's mostly structures that are called into question or in the process of self-destruction or already kind of laid waste, mostly. From what I see, like not really quite living anywhere, having grown up in the United States. And so it's almost like if we would be children, kind of feeling our way around and exploring and like maybe in a neighborhood of maybe abandoned houses or something like that, and trying to find where would we like to live and how would we like to live. And so we have that freedom as well as that kind of almost a sense of banishment, like we're not somewhere that's thriving culturally, mostly. Of course, I know, of course, there's tons of amazing art and dance and theater, et cetera. But in terms of, like, there's the weight of a self-destructing way of living. And the way children might explore and notice a detail along the way, and that might lead them to a particular house that might be viable or a particular way of living. But the way I've recently moved and was looking at houses, so, moved again. And my children came with me to look at the house that we just moved our stuff into and spent one night in and then came away. And the owner's stuff was still in there. And so they were easily distracted by sort of like this, I don't know, like a little cherubim statue on the wall or the paintings on the wall, which were not going to stay. My children were like, it's a great house, but I don't like that painting. Okay, the painting's not the house. And so I think we as children, it's easy to manipulate us also. There's the innocence of like noticing a detail and kind of following a trail and letting that evolve. Like, oh, I like the maybe gargoyle on the railing leading up to this house. Let's walk up the steps. And then, oh, I like this bug on the sidewalk. Let's continue a little further. And then finding our way somewhere. But it would be easy for an owner who wanted to rent or sell a house to kind of do it up, and for the child to be, oh, this place feels more neat and tidy because they've cut the lawn, whereas the much better house next door looks all messy. So it's easy to be manipulated. And I think that is hard for us I think especially, if I may say, in the United States, it's really hard for us to be as humble as we need to be at this moment. So I think we easily feel devastated, we easily feel alarmed, we easily feel up in arms. But to find that like humbleness, where part of us has an innocence that can find a way, that's not looking for whether it's the best way or better than, like, is this house the best house? You know, like, just finding a way that's very authentic. But to take into account how easily manipulable we are through appearances, through changes that are easy to put on to take us in. And maybe the power that we're mostly, more often missing, if we can sense the childlikeness of ourselves, both that innocence that could evolve and that easily fooled kind of, a candy house, you know, like, I want that one. Could be feeling more clearly, more simply, are the wounds, and that means not only my personal wounds, but our collective wounds. To clearly and simply delineate and feel and be in there. In a way that starts, that recovers the healing potential that a wound has. And that means it's not distractible by how painful it is. And one of the main things that that might mean in this country is that at the same time, maybe of us are starting to like be willing to come out of denial about the horrors, and to really, we already knew that, but like letting like up here come in touch with down here that already knew the horrors, like knowing the horrors. But at the same time, there's this way that maybe the United States has a that insular quality that we can make fun of, oh, those people that don't even know where Canada is, that kind of thing. But like really feeling we, not they, we, could easily have an insular quality and think that the horrors that happened here and happen here are really any different from the horrors that happened and happen anywhere else. And I just don't see how it is different, not in a special way. And that's what feels like that could free up a lot of energy, if it's like the horrors and leaving room for that to really come home. But not that the United States horrors are special. The taking of land, the enslavement of people, etc. The misogyny. All around the world, there's people living on top of other people's palaces and temples and holy places and disgraces. And it just feels like it might take some of the pressure out so that there is actually enough room to for the actual accommodation of what's gone wrong, because it's not special. Does that make sense? I mean, it's clear I'm not saying it. And it almost feels like it's hard to be here, in this country, and really do that. To open up the conversation beyond. There's already so much here. And I don't mean I don't mean to bypass what's local for you. But it's not special. When it's special, then there's like a paralysis that happens. And that's what I just notice when I come here, as something a little bit different, a certain paralysis, because there's such a sophistication in the subculture that's trying to really honor the tragedies. We get so sophisticated that it really does keep more towards a mental quality rather than a discovery, and it gets a bit frozen in how bad it is and was. And then we're tripping up, like we're not actually present, because it's gonna keep happening. I think now, 2 summers later, that's clear. Like, it's not like that was enough, or now that must be enough, because that, you know, it's like, no, it's gonna keep happening. And so some unfreezing, unparalyzing, and through the unspecialness, like, we can really get down to, it's like, because we care. And that is a powerful situation. To be able to bear that we care. And the I don't know if habit is a strong enough word, but let's play with calling it the habitual, like, avoidance of just getting down to, like, because we care as the root of everything. And from there, willingness to, however demanding it is, not from pressure, not from special, even if it's like special awful, not going towards that, but like feeling the room, the roominess, and possibilities, really, from because we care. And so if that could be like that, the little tiny flame that's easily extinguished. And if we don't mind being or looking ridiculous, doing anything we had to do to keep the flame alight. And it's not that we're making the flame, but we know what the flame needs. It needs some ventilation. It needs some fuel. And what would be the appropriate fuel and ventilation? And I would venture to just feel into one form of fuel. It could be like when the grieving has been done of anything. Any particular thing. Not just any generic thing, but any particular thing. Having grieved, letting it dry out, and feeding it to the fire. And that's really hard when not everybody has agreed, you know, not everybody has acknowledged. But are we going to wait around for that acknowledgement? Is that appropriate? Is it appropriate to wait for acknowledgement that, yes, that was a wound? Yes, that was a tragedy. Yes, that was a trial, etc. Whether personal, impersonal, something overlapping. Which mostly it does overlap. And so I feel like that the childlike quality, when we know from the childlike quality that it hurts, it's good, maybe it's good enough if like one person is like, yeah, that really hurts. Maybe, I don't want to make like a rule about it, but like, it doesn't have to be everybody in the world, but just, it feels like everybody, when it feels like everybody in the world. Someone was really there with you and yeah. And I think then the childlike is unencumbered by carrying the wound to make sure everybody, like, no, no, really, that hurt. That was really wrong. And being in the wound is where we can be in contact with a really mysterious, the mysteriousness of healing. In the wound, in the wound, not looking at the wound like, oh my God, I don't know if I can go there, but like in it, the wound wants and does heal. There's a knowing of what's needed. I'm not saying that it, in isolation, does that. Sometimes really amazingly without much help, without much input seemingly from anywhere else, but many times like with tons of community and, but knowing what's needed and having the follow through, like, no, today. And I think this is our subject, one of our subjects of now, in the open-ended space that our elders have led us to. That this is one of our practices. Is not like just that wound over there or that wound in there, but like in the wound, what is healing like? And it's a lot like that discovery of not the preconception, but oh, bone is really almost the opposite of what I expected. Does that make sense? Enough to chew on for.
More expansion for that noticing.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt both a lot of relief to be feeling known as it actually is, but I also felt a lot of fear. Noticing that more from your body,
mm-hmm.
actually being in it in life,
yeah,
is not here.
Yeah. And I think that's where we meet each other. And it, you know, sometimes it can be like, just someone to lean against, even literally. And very apt for the experience of wound. What we think it's going to be, heavy, dense, unchanging, not breathing, Like, hold your breath, bone. And so just to navigate the sense that being in it and where it moves immediately, when it has us, when it has some of our life presence, when a wound has us in it, usually there's an immediate dropping of like history and a movement. And that can be so disorienting. And so we feel like, am I being disloyal to what needs me? And so just kind of going through that many, many times. When I'm in it, it moves. It's like, oh yeah, let's go. You're here, let's go. Let's be different from being wounded. Let's be different. Not in a way that, this is maybe where we find our humbleness. Not in a way that feeds our ego, because it's like, the ego part would be, oh good, I'm done. And it's sort of, then it comes back in another way. Oh, you're here again? Let's move again. Let's move in another way. Let's unfold another petal. And the ego part is like, oh no, I thought I was done with that wound. I thought I did that work. I thought I was over it. Okay, so. Lissie L. Clifton. Mother tongue to the child just born. If I were eloquent in your language, I would try to tell you, to the child just born, I would try to tell you how it is when something difficult loves you, how it is when you begin to love it back, how this can cost you everything. I'll just read it again. Mother tongue to the child just born. If I were eloquent in your language, I would try to tell you how it is when something difficult loves you. How it is when you begin to love it back. How this can cost you everything. So I feel like she brought us, and rightly so, to here. And then what can come now is like, okay, and then what? Maybe we've started to notice that pleasant doesn't always mean, yeah, you're on the right track, keep going. And unpleasant doesn't always mean, watch out, you've gotten off track. We may have started to notice that just because there's a difficulty and it keeps coming around, doesn't necessarily mean something's wrong or right. But almost more, and this starts to be maybe our new territory, like what happens when we give up with this framework of right and wrong? If we stop like kind of tracking ourselves and taking leadership from right and wrong, which we could say it feels right or it feels wrong, but it's an ideology is what it is. And what I think we can't afford right now is even a minimal amount of ideology. And so we have a lot of practicing to do of what happens living with less and less ideology. What happens? The conditioning is that everything ends. If you don't have right and wrong to keep you on track, then, well, of course, you're going to self-destruct in 10 seconds or something like that. And it can feel that way. We can feel it. I think that there's something in our conditioning where our survival instinct gets kind of tapped into the sense of right and wrong. And so it feels like we're going to die if we cross that line, if we don't kind of obey in some way, or stay somehow in touch, even through rebelling against right and wrong. And there's a story I'd like to share. There's a little boy who would be considered, I don't know what the politically correct language is right now, but like really hard to deal with. Breaking stuff and having tantrums and not being convenient. And the parents at some point had separated, and the father of this child eventually went to see someone who works with families. And his name is Shai Orr. And Shai said to the father, "Oh, I'm so glad to hear that your son hasn't given up on you yet." And he wasn't just saying that, like Shai really means that. He really interprets this behavior that, whatever you want to call it, oh, trying to get attention. Yeah, he's trying to get your attention. That's exactly what he's doing. He needs your attention. And you haven't been giving him your attention. And he's still asking, despite everything. So we're still in time. Like, maybe it's never too late, but like he hasn't gone into the giving up stage, which most of us have, probably. And like coming back to life is like, whew, not so easy. Like when your leg falls asleep. Ava was coming to meet me in the back room, and I hadn't realized her leg was asleep, and I was forcing her to hobble along. Sorry. One time when I was 20, and my first time in India, and we were doing a Zen meditation in the Zen temple in Bodh Gaya, which is a major pilgrimage spot for Buddhists. And so we were actually at the front of the temple, like between the pilgrims and the statues and stuff, doing meditation. So it was practically a performance of like. Meditation as part of the scene that people would come to, 20-year-old Americans. And the routine was however long sitting cross-legged, but not really with cushions and stuff, and then immediately standing up and doing this very specific kind of walking meditation, which was luckily like half step. So you could kind of balance even without feeling one leg. Okay. And until you couldn't, and then I fell over in a tight circle. I just fell out of it. So to hear you and to hear each other as both the child that didn't give up yet, to hear where that's still alive, and to hear what we have called our wound, and when we relate to that wound in a very specific and maybe even very American kind of way, it starts to, almost like a pet, my pet wound. And we want to take care of our wound and everything, but we're not really in there until we're really in there. And then it all moves differently. You don't mind falling down when the circulation's coming back in. It's like, well, my leg's asleep, dude. And I fell over in your temple, yep. And the circulation's coming back in, and it is not comfortable. But I'm glad to have a leg. So I think that's enough for today. Let me just see. Does anyone want to ask for anything?
Very, very old habit of bracing in my body. I've been really working with it. Like it's an old vigilance from childhood. And I feel sometimes like, and I think this last chunk of time of you sharing has made me realize like sometimes it just feels like it's too much to like it will, the work of dissolving or dismantling will never be done. And so I've also continued to, like, even as I'm with it, I'm also still also, like, overriding and diverting around it. And I think it is, like, the crisis piece, like, just feeds right into that, you know? It's just, like, tailor-made for me to, yeah. Sort of, I guess, I don't know what the question is. It's something like, reconnecting like a little bit of a thread to like even a very small possibility, which I feel all the time, but I don't feel it in a visceral way, you know? I feel it in the more conceptual or intellectual. And even sometimes, I'm definitely in my heart, but like in the moment to moment living of it, this is still like, you know, happening.
I feel like that's also right on our edge, like where we are is, and one way to talk about it would be, yeah, if it were only you doing your efforts to dissolve your bracing problem, it will go on forever. And maybe what's kind of missing there is the sense that it's you and your individual efforts with a problem. And so starting to unwind not only the bracing that you feel, and you practice feeling it, you know, and it's even though it's kind of maybe meant to be a feeling to then not feel something else, but it's kind of, and even though it was a discovery to notice it at all, probably, it's still somehow something, it's kind of like the child acting out. It's like it's in a way made to be felt, to call your attention. And so maybe the fact that it's so easily felt isn't a problem in that way, and maybe we can even feel where there's some edges coming up, ways in. And so I think it can be helpful in terms of also that dissolving the sense of specialness is like, yeah, maybe it's going to go on forever. Maybe I will never conquer it. So what? And so not only the diverting and bypassing and coping kind of attitude, but like even though there's bracing going on, there's also what else? There's also like deep okayness. There's also already receptivity that's, you know, as wide as to the moon and back and more. Not to mention so many, you know, then individual gifts and so on. Like, it's so not important that there's bracing in one way. And in another way, it so needs you. And to hear it like the child, instead of like, you're in trouble, okay, now you're grounded for 3 weeks or whatever. in what way have I been listening like that?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm ready to listen like this, you know, in whatever other way. Because the father, that father, he was, you know, genuinely trying to meet his son and listen to him. And actually, I'll just tell the rest of the story quickly. What Shai prescribed was for the father to spend 3 days and nights with the son, just the two of them, like going camping or something. And the father, you know, at first would be like, oh my God, with this child, me alone, you know, I need reinforcements or whatever. Those ways that we think we need community where actually we can show up. But Shai said, don't do it if you're only doing it because I told you to, or even if you're only doing it because you think it's a good idea. Even if it's like good intention, and don't do it for that reason. Do it because you want to spend 3 days with your son. And eventually, when he was ready, he did, and it worked. In the sense of the son finally felt his father. And of course, the behavior changed, and then it becomes obvious. So that's kind of what I mean about that child. So for you, you haven't really one among probably many examples of that kind of where you've really been trying your best to meet that and what it's about and what's underlying and of course and the compassion and everything. But we haven't been taught, and also we haven't given ourselves space to discover because we thought it's too hard for me, it's too much for me, it's too ingrained or too powerful or too deep or something. And so just that little twinkle of confidence, which can also be like, well, everything else has failed basically, so what if I loosen instead of trying harder and another technique or another sophistication, but just even in the like, I don't know. Even with a child, literally, it would be like, well, I don't know what you're asking for, is more listening than what we usually do. And it's subtle, and but then the quality is obvious. The quality difference is obvious when we're really listening. And that partly means really taking off the armor that we thought we had to know how to do it. It's really like coming back to where I know I don't know. But it would be then hearing the life force in the child or in the bracing or in the, even anything, any pattern, judgment, compulsive thinking, whatever it is. Hearing that aliveness in there, asking for basically easeful kind of contact. So where someone is, so for me, that's the best way to talk about listening, is someone is really, really present, but they're not trying to give me a quick, fancy answer. They're trusting that it's gonna come, like the wound knows how to heal. We can listen inwardly and outwardly, leaving room for the discovery element, the discovery mode to happen alone and together. And it does, and it's amazing. It's just so surprising time and again. So then it can also be listening to the part that wants to be over and done with the bracing and hearing why that's an insult. That there's something that you haven't gotten rid of or whatever, or yeah, all the different things that might be there. And it's I think that there's one simple aspect that it is so humbling to keep coming up against, like, well, from one perspective, it's partly just that this is uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable in my body with the bracing. And then something that just directly translates uncomfort as something's wrong with me. Instead of it's uncomfortable because it's alive and it would like to move somehow. or it would like to express, or it would like to something. Mm-hmm. It would like to be listened to. Yeah, just the word prophecy. pro, like, could be before or in front of. And then the fet part would be about speaking. And I just wonder if we could feel listening as the environment where prophecy happens. So where a voice or a movement, a communication, an expression, something radiates or emanates from life. It just comes off of us. If that could be the voice part, the speaking, the communication. That playful, demanding evolutionary leap, movement, that just comes forth in an environment that's and even what is listening, you know, so tuning in without pinpointing, without fixating, so it's something that's got focus but fluidity, and if we can add being at ease in listening. It's something we know how to do. And it doesn't take much to shift into that. But it does take what we've been trained not to give. So maybe just for a few moments now at the end, just more in silence, feeling like what would listening feel like? So I notice my body, if I'm listening, I would like kind of lean in and hunker down and like vacate the head, really coming in, but then easeful, like being at ease, like, oh no, there's no need to add anything. Playing with bringing those, mixing those two colors. And so what's cool about being in a retreat where we don't all sleep in the same building is where you can really play with that in the more unpredictable situations you'll come across later. So we can have our break. And maybe if in about 10 minutes we could come back here. I'm not sure how to, when I do retreats, I like to end the day with singing, but I like for it to be optional. So, because not everybody is into singing. And also, once you come out of silence and it's like, okay, we're going to sing one song and we're not going to all sing different songs. We're going to all sing one song. And it will just be the case that not everybody will kind of get into that one song. So, what about today we just have a silent meditation from 5:30 to 6? Because it's already 5:20. The talk was supposed to end 20 minutes ago, according to the paper. And if we could just hear from everybody, if you feel like I would really love to sing or I really, really don't want to sing, and then we can factor that in for tomorrow. But since there's already been like way more talking than there will be tomorrow, let's just have a silent meditation. Does that sound fine? Okay. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us.